Side 6, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, continuing on page 189. Conducting the class was a tall, blonde, blue-eyed, a perfect devil, Harvard Seminary student. He lectured, and then he started in a question-and-answer session. I don't know which of us had read the Bible more, he or I, but I had to give him credit. He really was heavy on his religion. I puzzled and puzzled for a way to upset him and to give those Negroes present something to think and talk about and circulate. Finally, I put up my hand. He nodded. He talked about Paul. I stood up and asked, "What color was Paul?" And I kept talking with pauses. He had to be black because he was a Hebrew. And the original Hebrews were black, weren't they? He had started flushing red. You know the way white people do. He said, "Yes." I wasn't through yet. "What color was Jesus?" "He was Hebrew too, wasn't he?" Both the Negro and the white convicts had sat bolt upright. I don't care how tough the convict, be he brainwashed black Christian or a devil white Christian, neither of them is ready to hear anybody saying Jesus wasn't white. The instructor walked around. He shouldn't have felt bad. In all of the years since, I never met any intelligent white man who would try to insist that Jesus was white. How could they? He said, "Jesus was brown." I let him get away with that compromise. Exactly as I'd known it would, almost overnight the Charlestown convicts, black and white, began buzzing with the story. Wherever I went, I could feel the nodding. And any time I got a chance to exchange words with a black brother in stripes, I'd say, "My man, you ever heard about somebody named Mr. Elijah Muhammad?" Chapter 12, Savior. During the spring of 1952, I joyously wrote Elijah Muhammad and my family to the Massachusetts State Parole Board and voted that I should be released. But still a few months were taken up with the red tape delay of paperwork that went back and forth, arranging for my parole release from the custody of my oldest brother, Wilfred, in Detroit, who now managed a furniture store. Wilfred got the Jew who owned the store to sign a promise that upon release I would be given immediate employment. By the prison system wire, I heard that Shorty also was up for parole. But Shorty was having trouble getting some reputable person to sign for him. Later I found out that in prison Shorty had studied musical composition. He had even progressed to writing some pieces. One of them I know he named the Bastille Concerto. My going to Detroit instead of back to Harlem or Boston was influenced by my family's feeling expressed in their letters. Especially my sister Hilda had stressed to me that although I felt I understood Elijah Muhammad's teachings, I had much to learn, and I ought to come to Detroit and become a member of a temple of practicing Muslims. It was in August when they gave me a lecture, a cheap Lil Abner suit, and a small amount of money, and I walked out of the gate. I never looked back, but that doesn't make me any different from a million inmates who have left a prison behind them. The first stop I made was at a Turkish bath. I got some of that physical feeling of prison taint steamed off me. Ella, with whom I stayed only overnight, had also agreed that it would be best for me to start again in Detroit. The police in a new city wouldn't have it in for me. That was Ella's consideration, not the Muslims, for whom Ella had no use. Both Hilda and Reginald had tried to work on Ella, but Ella, with her strong will, didn't go for it at all. She told me that she felt anyone could be whatever he wanted to be, holy roller, Seventh-day Adventist, or whatever it was, but she wasn't going to become any Muslim. Hilda, the next morning, gave me some money to put in my pocket. Before I left, I went out and bought three things I remember well. I bought a better-looking pair of eyeglasses than the pair the prison had issued to me, and I bought a suitcase and a wristwatch. I thought since that without fully knowing it, I was preparing for what my life was about to become, because those are three things I've used more than anything else. My eyeglasses correct the astigmatism that I got from all the reading in prison. I travel so much now that my wife keeps alternate suitcases packed so that when necessary I can just grab one. And you won't find anybody more time-conscious than I am. I live by my watch, keeping appointments. Even when I'm using my car, I drive by my watch, not my speedometer. Time is more important to me than distance. I caught a bus to Detroit. The furniture store that my brother Wilfred managed was right in the black ghetto of Detroit. I better not name the store if I'm going to tell the way they robbed Negroes. Wilfred introduced me to the Jews who owned the store, and as agreed, I was put to work as a salesman. Nothing down advertisements drew poor Negroes into that store like flypaper. It was a shame the way they paid 3 and 4 times what the furniture had cost because they could get credit from those jewelers. It was the same kind of cheap, gaudy-looking junk that you can see in any of the black ghetto furniture stores today. Fabrics were stapled on the sofas. Imitation leopard skin bedspreads. Tiger skin rugs, such stuff as that. I would see clumsy, work-hardened, calloused hands scrawling and scratching signatures on the contract, agreeing to highway robbery interest rates in the fine print that never was read. I was seeing in real life the same point made in a joke that during the 1964 presidential campaign, Jet magazine reported that Senator Barry Goldwater had told somewhere. It was that a white man, a Negro, and a Jew were given one wish each. The white man asked for securities. The Negro asked for a lot of money. The Jew asked for some imitation jewelry and that colored boy's address. In all my years in the streets, I've been looking at the exploitation that for the first time I really saw and understood. Now I watch brothers entwining themselves in the economic clutches of the white man who went home every night with another bag of the money drained out of the ghetto. I saw that the money, instead of helping the black man, was going to help enrich these white merchants who usually lived in an exclusive area where a black man had better not get caught unless he worked there for somebody white. Wilfred invited me to share his home, and gratefully I accepted. The warmth of a home and a family was a healing change from the prison cage for me. It would deeply move almost any newly freed convict, I think. But especially this Muslim home's atmosphere sent me often to my knees to praise Allah. My family's letters while I was in prison had included a description of the Muslim home routine, but to truly appreciate it, one had to be a part of the routine. Each act and the significance of that act was gently, patiently explained to me by my brother Wilfred. There was none of the morning confusion that exists in most homes. Wilfred, the father, the family protector and provider, was the first to rise. "The father prepares the way for his family," he said. He, then I, performed the morning ablutions. Next came Wilfred's wife, Ruth, and then their children, so that orderliness prevailed in the use of the bathroom. "In the name of Allah, I perform the ablutions," the Muslim said aloud before washing first the right hand, then the left hand. The teeth were thoroughly brushed, followed by 3 rinsings out of the mouth. The nostrils also were rinsed out thrice. A shower then completed the whole body's purification in readiness for prayer. Each family member, even children upon meeting each other for that new day's first time, greeted softly and pleasantly, "As-salamu alaykum," the Arabic for "peace be unto you," "wa alaykum salam," and "unto you be peace," was the other's reply. Over and over again, the Muslim said in his own mind, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah is the greatest." The prayer rug was spread by Wilfred, while the rest of the family purified themselves. It was explained to me that a Muslim family prayed with the sun near the horizon. If that time was missed, the prayer had to be deferred until the sun was beyond the horizon. Muslims are not sun worshippers. We pray facing the east to be in unity with the rest of our 725 million brothers and sisters in the entire Muslim world. All the family, in robes, lined up facing east. In unison, we stepped from our slippers to stand on the prayer rug. Today, I say with my family in the Arabic tongue, the prayer which I first learned in English. I perform the morning prayer to Allah, the Most High. Allah is the greatest. Glory to thee, O Allah. Thine is the praise. Blessed is thy name, and exalted is thy majesty. I bear witness that nothing deserves to be served or worshipped besides thee. No solid food, only juice and coffee, was taken for our breakfast. Wilfred and I went off to work. There at noon, and again at around 3 in the afternoon, unnoticed by others in the furniture store, we would rinse our hands, faces, and mouths, and softly meditate. Muslim children did likewise at school, and Muslim wives and mothers interrupted their chores to join the world's 725 million Muslims in communicating with God. Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays were the meeting days of the relatively small Detroit Temple No. 1. Near the temple, which actually was a storefront, were three hog-slaughtering pens. The squealing of hogs being slaughtered filtered into our Wednesday and Friday meetings. I'm describing the condition that we Muslims were in back in the early 1950s. The address of Temple No. 1 was 1470 Frederick Street, I think. The first temple to be formed back in 1931 by Master W.D. Fard was formed in Detroit, Michigan. I never had seen any Christian-believing Negroes conduct themselves like the Muslims, the individuals and the families alike. The men were quietly, tastefully dressed. The women wore ankle-length gowns, no makeup, and scarves covered their heads. The neat children were mannerly not only to adults, but to other children as well. I never dreamed of anything like that atmosphere among black people who had learned to be proud they were black, who had learned to love other black people instead of being jealous and suspicious. I thrilled to how we Muslim men used both hands to grasp a black brother's both hands, voicing and smiling our happiness to meet him again. The Muslim sisters, both married and single, were given an honor and respect that I'd never seen black men give to their women, and it felt wonderful to me. The salutations which we all exchanged were warm, filled with mutual respect and dignity. Brother, sister, ma'am, sir. Even children speaking to other children used these terms. Beautiful. Lemuel Hassan then was the minister at Temple No. 1. As-salaykum, he greeted us. Wa-salaykum, we returned. Minister Lemuel stood before us near a blackboard. The blackboard had fixed upon it in permanent paint on one side the United States flag and under it the words slavery, suffering, and death. Then the word Christianity alongside the sign of the cross. Beneath the cross was a painting of a black man hanged from a tree. On the other side was painted what we were taught was the Muslim flag, the crescent and star on a red background with the words Islam, freedom, justice, equality. And beneath that, which one will survive the war of Armageddon? For more than an hour, Minister Lemuel lectured about Elijah Muhammad's teachings. I sat raptly absorbing Minister Lemuel's every syllable and gesture. Frequently, he graphically illustrated points by chalking key words or phrases on the blackboard. I thought it was outrageous that our small temple still had some empty seats. I complained to my brother Wilfred that there should be no empty seats, with the surrounding streets full of our brainwashed black brothers and sisters, drinking, cursing, fighting, dancing, carousing, and using dope. The very things that Mr. Muhammad taught were helping the black man to stay under the heel of the white man here in America. From what I could gather, the recruitment attitude of the temple seemed to me to amount to a self-defeating waiting view, an assumption that Allah would bring us more Muslims. I felt that Allah would be more inclined to help those who help themselves. I'd lived for years in ghetto streets. I knew the Negroes in those streets. Harlem or Detroit were no different. I said I disagreed, that I thought we should go out into the streets and get more Muslims into the fold. All of my life, as you know, I had been an activist. I'd been impatient. My brother Wilfred counseled me to keep patience. And for me to be patient was made easier by the fact that I could anticipate soon seeing and perhaps meeting the man who was called the messenger, Elijah Muhammad himself. Today I have appointments with world-famous personages, including some heads of nations. But I looked forward to the Sunday before Labor Day in 1952 with an eagerness never since duplicated. Detroit Temple No. 1 Muslims were going in a motor caravan, I think about 10 automobiles, to visit Chicago Temple No. 2 to hear Elijah Muhammad. Not since childhood had I been so excited as when we drove in Wilfred's car. At great Muslim rallies since then, I've seen and heard and felt 10,000 black people applauding and cheering. But on that Sunday afternoon, when our two little temples assembled, perhaps only 200 Muslims, the Chicagoans welcoming and greeting us Detroiters, I experienced tinglings up my spine as I've never had since. I was totally unprepared for the messenger Elijah Muhammad's physical impact upon my emotions. From the rear of Temple No. 2, he came toward the platform. The small, sensitive, gentle, brown face that I'd studied on photographs until I dreamed about it was fixed straight ahead as the messenger strode, encircled by the marching, strapping fruit of Islam guards. The messenger, compared to them, seemed fragile, almost tiny. He and the fruit of Islam were dressed in dark suits, white shirts, and bow ties. The messenger wore a gold-embroidered fez. I stared at the great man who had taken the time to write to me when I was a convict whom he knew nothing about. He was the man whom I had been told had spent years of his life in suffering and sacrifice to lead us, the black people, because they loved us so much. And then, hearing his voice, I sat leaning forward, riveted upon his words. I tried to reconstruct what Elijah Muhammad said from having since heard him speak hundreds of times. I have not stopped one day for the past 21 years. I have been standing preaching to you throughout those past 21 years. While I was free, and even while I was in bondage, I spent 3.5 years in the federal penitentiary, and also over a year in the city jail for teaching this truth. I was also deprived of a father's love for his family for 7 long years while I was running from hypocrites and other enemies of this word and revelation of God, which will give life to you and put you on the same level with all other civilized and independent nations and peoples of this planet Earth. Elijah Muhammad spoke of how in this wilderness of North America, for centuries, the blue-eyed, devil, white man had brainwashed the so-called Negro. He told us how, as one result, the black man in America was mentally, morally, and spiritually dead. Elijah Muhammad spoke of how the black man was original man, who had been kidnapped from his homeland and stripped of his language, his culture, his family structure, his family name, until the black man in America did not even realize who he was. He told us and showed us how his teachings of the true knowledge of ourselves would lift up the black man from the bottom of the white man's society and place the black man where he had begun, at the top of civilization. Concluding, pausing for a breath, he called my name. It was like an electrical shock. Not looking at me directly, he asked me to stand. He told them that I was just out of prison. He said how strong I had been while in prison. Every day, he said, for years, Brother Malcolm has written a letter from prison to me, and I have written to him as often as I could. Standing there, feeling the eyes of the 200 Muslims upon me, I heard him make a parable about me. When God bragged about how faithful Job was, said Elijah Muhammad, the devil said only God's hedge around Job kept Job so faithful. Remove that protective hedge, the devil told God, and I will make Job curse you to your face. The devil could claim that, hedged in prison, I had just used Islam, Mr. Muhammad said. But the devil would say that now, out of prison, I would return to my drinking, smoking, dope, and life of crime. Well now, our good brother Malcolm's hedge is removed, and we will see how he does, Mr. Muhammad said. I believe that he's going to remain faithful. And Allah blessed me to remain true, firm, and strong in my faith in Islam despite many severe trials to my faith. And even when events produced a crisis between Elijah Muhammad and me, I told him at the beginning of the crisis, with all the sincerity I had in me, that I still believed in him more strongly than he believed in himself. Mr. Muhammad and I are not together today only because of envy and jealousy. I had more faith in Elijah Muhammad than I could ever have in any other man upon this earth. You will remember my having said that when I was in prison, Mr. Muhammad would be my brother Wilfred's house guest whenever he visited Detroit Temple No. 1. Every Muslim said that never could you do as much for Mr. Muhammad as he would do for you in return. That Sunday, after the meeting, he invited our entire family group and Minister Lemuel Hassan to be his guests for dinner that evening at his new home. Mr. Muhammad said that his children and his followers had insisted that he move into this larger, better 18-room house in Chicago at 4847 Woodlawn Avenue. They just moved in that week, I believe. When we arrived, Mr. Muhammad showed us where he had just been painting. I had to restrain my impulse to run and bring a chair for the Messenger of Allah. Instead, as I had heard he would do, he was worrying about my comfort. We'd hoped to hear his wisdom during the dinner, but instead he encouraged us to talk. I sat thinking of how our Detroit temple more or less just sat and awaited Allah to bring converts, and beyond that of the millions of black people all over America who never had heard of the teachings that could stir and wake and resurrect the black man. And there at Mr. Muhammad's table, I found my tongue. I've always been one to speak my mind. During a conversational lull, I asked Mr. Muhammad how many Muslims were supposed to be in our temple No. 1 in Detroit. He said, there are supposed to be thousands. Yes, sir, I said. Sir, what is your opinion of the best way of getting thousands there? Go after the young people, he said. Once you get them, the older ones will follow through shame. I made up my mind that we were going to follow that advice. Back in Detroit, I talked with my brother Wilfred. I offered my services to our temple's minister, Lemuel Hassan. He shared my determination that we should apply Mr. Muhammad's formula in a recruitment drive. Beginning that day, every evening, straight from work at the furniture store, I went doing what we Muslims later came to call fishing. I knew the thinking and the language of ghetto streets. My man, let me pull your coat to something. My application had, of course, been made, and during this time I received from Chicago my X. The Muslim's X symbolized the true African family name that he never could know. For me, my X replaced the white slave master name of Little, which some blue-eyed devil named Little had imposed upon my paternal forebears. The receipt of my X meant that forever after in the nation of Islam, I would be known as Malcolm X. Mr. Muhammad taught that we would keep this X until God himself returned and gave us a holy name from his own mouth. Recruit as I would in the Detroit ghetto bars, in the pool rooms, and on the corners, I found my poor, ignorant, brainwashed black brothers mostly too deaf, dumb, and blind, mentally, morally, and spiritually, to respond. It angered me that only now and then would one display even a little curiosity about the teachings that would resurrect the black man. These few I would almost beg to visit Temple Number 1 at our next meeting, but then not half of those who agreed to come would actually show up. Gradually, enough were made interested, though, that each month a few more automobiles lengthened our caravans to Temple 2 in Chicago. But even after seeing and hearing Elijah Muhammad in person, only a few of the interested visitors would apply by formal letter to Mr. Muhammad to be accepted for Nation of Islam membership. With a few months of plugging away, however, our storefront Temple 1 about tripled its membership, and that so deeply pleased Mr. Muhammad that he paid us the honor of a personal visit. Mr. Muhammad gave me warm praise when Minister Lemuel Hassan told how hard I'd labored in the cause of Islam. Our caravans grew. I remember with what pride we led 25 automobiles to Chicago, and each time we went, we were honored with dinner at the home of Elijah Muhammad. He was interested in my potential, I could tell from things he would say. And I worshipped him. In early 1953, I left the furniture store. I earned a little better weekly paycheck working at the Gar Wood Factory in Detroit, where big garbage truck bodies were made. I cleaned up behind the welders each time they finished another truck body. Mr. Muhammad was saying at his dining table by this time that one of his worst needs was more young men willing to work as hard as they would have to in order to bear the responsibilities of his ministers. He was saying that the teaching should be spreading further than they had, and temples needed to be established in other cities. It simply never occurred to me that I might be a minister. I never felt remotely qualified to directly represent Mr. Muhammad. If someone had asked me about becoming a minister, I would have been astonished and told them I was happy and willing to serve Mr. Muhammad in the lowliest capacity. I don't know if Mr. Muhammad suggested it or if our Temple One minister, Lemuel Hassan, in his own decision, encouraged me to address our assembled brothers and sisters. I know that I testified to what Mr. Muhammad's teachings had done for me. If I told you the life I've lived, you would find it hard to believe me. When I say something about the white man, I am not talking about someone I don't know. Soon after that, Minister Lemuel Hassan urged me to address the brothers and sisters with an extemporaneous lecture. I was uncertain and hesitant, but at least I debated in prison, and I tried my best. Of course, I can't remember exactly what I said, but I do know that in my beginning efforts, my favorite subject was Christianity and the horrors of slavery, where I felt well equipped from so much reading in prison. My brothers and sisters, our white slave master's Christian religion has taught us black people here in the wilderness of North America that we will sprout wings when we die and fly up into the sky where God will have for us a special place called heaven. This is white man's Christian religion used to brainwash us black people. We have accepted it. We have embraced it. We have believed it. We have practiced it. And while we are doing all of that for himself, this blue-eyed devil has twisted his Christianity to keep his foot on our backs, to keep our eyes fixed on the pie in the sky and heaven in the hereafter, while he enjoys his heaven right here on this earth in this life. Today, when thousands of Muslims and others have been audiences out before me, when audiences of millions have been beyond radio and television microphones, I'm sure I rarely feel as much electricity as was then generated in me by the upturned faces of those 75 or 100 Muslims, plus other curious visitors, sitting there in our storefront temple with the squealing of pigs filtering in from the slaughterhouse just outside. In the summer of 1953, all praise is due to Allah, I was named Detroit Temple No. 1's assistant minister. Every day after work, I walked, fishing for potential converts in the Detroit black ghetto. I saw the African features of my black brothers and sisters whom the devilish white man had brainwashed. I saw the hair as mine had been for years, conked by cooking it with lye until it lay limp, looking straight like the white man's hair. Time and again, Mr. Muhammad's teachings were rebuffed and even ridiculed. "Oh, man, get out of my face. You niggers are crazy." My head would reel sometimes with mingled anger and pity for my poor, blind black brothers. I couldn't wait for the next time our minister, Lemuel Hassan, would let me speak. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock, my brothers and sisters. Plymouth Rock landed on us. Give all you can to help Messenger Elijah Muhammad's independence program for the black man. This white man always has controlled us black people by keeping us running to him begging, "Please, Lordy, please, Mr. White Man Boss, would you push me off another crumb down from your table that's sagging with riches?" My beautiful black brothers and sisters. And when we say black, we mean everything not white, brothers and sisters, because look at your skins. We're all black to the white man, but we're 1,001 different colors. Turn around. Look at each other. What shade of black African polluted by devil white man are you? You see me? Well, in the streets they used to call me Detroit Red. Yes, yes, that raping red-headed devil was my grandfather. That close, yes, my mother's father. She didn't like to speak of it. Can you blame her? She said she never laid eyes on him. She was glad for that. I'm glad for her. If I could drain away his blood that pollutes my body and pollutes my complexion, I'd do it. Because I hate every drop of the rapist's blood that's in me. And it's not just me. It's all of us. During slavery, think of it. It was a rare one of our black grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, and our great-great-grandmothers who escaped the white rapist slave master. That rapist slave master who emasculated the black man with threats, with fear. Until even today, the black man lives with fear of the white man in his heart. Lives even today still under the heel of the white man. Think of it. Think of that black slave man filled with fear and dread, hearing the screams of his wife, his mother, his daughter being taken in the barn, the kitchen, in the bushes. Think of it, my dear brothers and sisters. Think of hearing wives, mothers, daughters being raped, and you were too filled with fear of the rapist to do anything about it, and his vicious animal attacks offspring. This white man named things like mulatto and quadroon and octoroon and all those other things that he's called us, you and me, when he's not calling us nigger. Turn around and look at each other, brothers and sisters, and think of this. You and me polluted all these colors, and this devil has the arrogance and the gall to think we, his victims, should love him. I would become so choked up that sometimes I would walk in the streets until late into the night. Sometimes I would speak to no one for hours, thinking to myself about what the white man had done to our poor people here in America. At the Garwood factory where I worked, one day the supervisor came, looking nervous. He said that a man in the office was waiting to see me. The white man standing in there said, "I'm from the FBI. He flipped open, that way they do to shock you, his little folded black leather case containing his identification. He told me to come with him. He didn't say for what or why. I went with him. They wanted to know at their office why hadn't I registered for the Korean War draft. I just got out of prison, I said. I didn't know you took anybody with prison records. They really believed I thought ex-convicts weren't supposed to register. They asked a lot of questions. I was glad they didn't ask if I intended to put on the white man's uniform, because I didn't. They just took it for granted that I would. They told me they weren't going to send me to jail for failing to register, that they were going to give me a break, but that I would have to register immediately. So I went straight from there to the draft board. When they gave me a form to fill out, I wrote in the appropriate places that I was a Muslim and that I was a conscientious objector. I turned in the form. This middle-aged, bored-acting devil who scanned it looked out from under his eyes at me. He got up and went into another office, obviously to consult someone over him. After a while, he came out and motioned for me to go in there. These three, I believe there were three as I remember, older devils sat behind desks. They all wore that troublesome nigger expression. And I looked, white devil, right back into their eyes. They asked me on what basis did I claim to be a Muslim in my religion. I told them that the messenger of Allah was Mr. Elijah Muhammad, and that all who followed Mr. Muhammad here in America were Muslims. I knew they had heard this before from some Temple One young brothers who had been there before me. They asked if I knew what conscientious objector meant. I told them that when the white man asked me to go off somewhere and fight and maybe die to preserve the way the white man treated the black man in America, then my conscience made me object. They told me that my case would be pending, but I was put through the physical anyway, and they sent me a card with some kind of a classification. That was 1953. Then I heard no more for 7 years when I received another classification card in the mail. In fact, I carry it in my wallet right now. Here. It's card number 20219251377. It's dated November 21st, 1960. It says Class 5A, whatever that means. And stamped on the card's back is Michigan Local Board Number 19, Wayne County, 3604 South Wayne Road, Wayne, Michigan. Every time I spoke at our Temple One, my voice would still be hoarse from the last time. My throat took a long time to get into condition. Do you know why the white man really hates you? It's because every time he sees your face, he sees a mirror of his crime, and his guilty conscience can't bear to face it. Every white man in America, when he looks into a black man's eyes, should fall to his knees and say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry. My kind has committed history's greatest crime against your kind. Will you give me the chance to atone?" But do you brothers and sisters expect any white man to do that? No, you know better. And why won't he do it? Because he can't do it. The white man was created a devil to bring chaos upon this earth. Somewhere about this time, I left the Garwood factory and I went to work for the Ford Motor Company, one of the Lincoln Mercury Division assembly lines. As a young minister, I would go to Chicago and see Mr. Elijah Muhammad every time I could get off. He encouraged me to come when I could. I was treated as if I'd been one of the sons of Mr. Muhammad and his dark, good wife, Sister Clara Muhammad. I saw their children only occasionally. Most of them in those years worked around Chicago in various jobs, laborers, driving taxis, and things such as that. Also living in the home was Mr. Muhammad's dear mother, Marie. I would spend almost as much time with Mother Marie as I did with Mr. Muhammad. I loved to hear her reminiscences about her son Elijah's early life when they lived in Sandersville, Georgia, where he was born in 1897. Mr. Muhammad would talk with me for hours. After eating good, healthful Muslim food, we would stay at the dinner table and talk. Or I would ride with him as he drove on his daily rounds between the few grocery stores that the Muslims then owned in Chicago. The stores were examples to help black people see what they could do for themselves by hiring their own kind and trading with their own kind, and thus quit being exploited by the white man. In the Muslim-owned combination grocery drugstore on Wentworth and 31st Street, Mr. Muhammad would sweep the floor or something like that. He would do such work himself as an example to his followers, whom he taught that idleness and laziness were among the black man's greatest sins against himself. I would want to snatch the broom from Mr. Muhammad's hand because I thought he was too valuable to be sweeping a floor. But he wouldn't let me do anything but stay with him and listen while he advised me on the best ways to spread his message. The way we were with each other, it would make me think of Socrates on the steps of the Athens marketplace, spreading his wisdom to his students. Or how one of those students, Aristotle, had his students following behind him, walking through the Lyceum. One day, I remember, a dirty glass of water was on a counter, and Mr. Muhammad put a clean glass of water beside it. "You want to know how to spread my teachings?" he said, and he pointed to the glasses of water. "Don't condemn if you see a person has a dirty glass of water," he said. "Just show them the clean glass of water that you have. When they inspect it, you won't have to say that yours is better." Of all the things that Mr. Muhammad ever was to teach me, I don't know why, that still stands out in my mind, although I haven't always practiced it. I love too much to battle. I'm inclined to tell somebody if his glass of water is dirty. Mother Marie, when Mr. Muhammad was busy, would tell me about her son's boyhood and of his growing up in Georgia to young manhood. Mother Marie's account of her son began when she was herself but 7 years old. She told me that then she had a vision that one day she would be the mother of a very great man. She married a Baptist minister, Reverend Poole, who worked around Sandersville on the farms and in the sawmills. "Among their 13 children," said Mother Marie, "little Elijah was very different, almost from when he could walk and talk. The small, frail boy usually settled his older brothers and sisters' disputes," Mother Marie said. "And young as he was, he became regarded by them as their leader. And Elijah, about the time he entered school, began displaying a strong race consciousness. After the fourth grade, because the family was so poor, Elijah had to quit school and begin full-time working. An older sister taught Elijah as much as she was able at night. Mother Marie said that Elijah spent hours poring through the Bible with tears shining in his eyes. Mr. Muhammad told me himself later that as a boy he felt that the Bible's words were a locked door that could be unlocked if only he knew how, and he cried because of his frustrated anxiety to receive understanding. Elijah grew up into a still, frail teenager who displayed a most uncommonly strong love for his race. And Mother Marie said, instead of condemning Negroes' faults, young Elijah always would speak of reasons for those faults. Mother Marie has since died. I believe that she had as large a funeral as Chicago has seen. Not only Muslims, but others knew of the deep bond that Messenger Elijah had with his mother. I'm not ashamed to say how little learning I've had, Mr. Muhammad told me. My going to school no further than the fourth grade proves that I can know nothing except the truth I have been taught by Allah. Allah taught me mathematics. He found me with a sluggish tongue and taught me how to pronounce words. Mr. Muhammad said that somehow he never could stand how the Sandersville white farmers, the sawmill foremen, or other white employers would habitually and often curse Negro workers. He said he would politely ask any for whom he worked never to curse him. I would ask them to just fire me if they didn't like my work, but just don't curse me. Mr. Muhammad's ordinary conversation was the manner he used when making speeches. He was not eloquent, as eloquence is usually meant, but whatever he uttered had an impact on me that trained orators did not begin to have. He said that on the jobs he got, he worked so honestly that generally he was put in charge of the other Negroes. After Mr. Muhammad and Sister Clara met and married, and their first two children had been born, a white employer early in 1923 did curse Mr. Muhammad, then Elijah Poole. Elijah Poole, determined to avoid trouble, took his family to Detroit, arriving when he was 25. Five more children would be born there in Detroit, and finally, the last one in Chicago. In Detroit in 1931, Mr. Muhammad met Master W. D. Fard. The effects of the Depression were bad everywhere, but in the black ghetto they were horrible, Mr. Muhammad told me. A small, light brown-skinned man knocked from door to door at the apartments of the poverty-stricken Negroes. The man offered for sale silks and other yard goods, and he identified himself as a brother from the East. This man began to tell Negroes how they came from a distant land in the seeds of their forefathers. He warned them against eating the filthy pig and other wrong foods that it was habitual for Negroes to eat. Among the Negroes whom he found most receptive, he began holding little meetings in their poor homes. The man taught both the Quran and the Bible, and his students included Elijah Poole. This man said his name was W. D. Fard. He said that he was born in the Quraysh tribe of Muhammad ibn Abdullah, the Arabian prophet himself. This peddler of silks and yard goods, Mr. W. D. Fard, knew the Bible better than any of the Christian-bred Negroes. In the essence, Mr. W. D. Fard taught that God's true name was Allah, that his true religion was Islam, that the true name for that religion's people was Muslims. Mr. W. D. Fard taught that the Negroes in America were directly descended from Muslims. He taught that Negroes in America were lost sheep, lost for 400 years from the nation of Islam, and that he, Mr. Fard, had come to redeem and return the Negro to his true religion. No heaven was in the sky, Mr. Fard taught, and no hell was in the ground. Instead, both heaven and hell were conditions in which people lived right here on this planet Earth. Mr. Fard taught that the Negro in America had been for 400 years in hell, and he, Mr. Fard, had come to return them to where heaven for them was, back home, among their own kind. Master Fard taught that as hell was on earth, also on earth was the devil, the white race which was bred from black original man 6,000 years before, purposely to create a hell on earth for the next 6,000 years. The black people, God's children, were gods themselves, Master Fard taught. And he taught that among them was one, also a human being like the others, who was the God of gods, the most high, the supreme being, supreme in wisdom and power, and his proper name was Allah. Among his handful of first converts in 1931 in Detroit, Master W.D. Fard taught that every religion says that near the last day, or near the end of time, God would come to resurrect the lost sheep, to separate them from their enemies, and restore them to their own people. Master Fard taught that prophecy referred to this finder and savior of the lost sheep as the Son of Man, or God in person, or the life-giver, the Redeemer, or the Messiah, who would come as lightning from the east and appear in the west. He was the one to whom the Jews referred as the Messiah, the Christians as the Christ, and the Muslims as the Mahdi. I would sit galvanized, hearing what I then accepted from Mr. Muhammad's own mouth as being the true history of our religion, the true religion for the black man. Mr. Muhammad told me that one evening he had a revelation that Master W.D. Fard represented the fulfillment of the prophecy. I asked him, said Mr. Muhammad, who are you, and what is your real name? And he said, I am the one the world has been looking for to come for the past 2,000 years. I said to him again, said Mr. Muhammad, what is your true name? And then he said, my name is Mahdi. I came to guide you into the right path. Mr. Elijah Muhammad says that he sat listening with an open heart and an open mind, the way I was sitting listening to Mr. Muhammad. And Mr. Muhammad said he never doubted any word that the Savior taught him. Starting to organize, Master W.D. Fard set up a class for training ministers to carry the teachings to America's black people. In giving names to these first ministers, Master Fard named Elijah Poole Elijah Carrion. Next, Master W.D. Fard established in 1931 in Detroit a University of Islam. It had adult classes which taught, among other things, mathematics to help the poor Negroes quit being duped and deceived by the tricknology of the blue-eyed devil white man. Starting a school in the rough meant that it lacked qualified teachers, but a start had to be made somewhere. Mr. Elijah Carrion removed his own children from Detroit public schools to start a nucleus of children in the University of Islam. Mr. Muhammad told me that his older children's lack of formal education reflected their sacrifice to form the backbone for today's universities of Islam in Detroit and Chicago, which have better qualified faculties. Master W.D. Fard selected Elijah Carrion to be the supreme minister over all other ministers, and among all of those others sprang up a bitter jealousy. All of them had better education than Elijah Carrion, and also they were more articulate than he was. They raged, even in his presence. Why should we bow down to someone who appears less qualified? But Mr. Elijah Carrion was then in some way renamed Elijah Muhammad, who as the supreme minister began to receive from Master W.D. Fard for the next 3.5 years private teachings, during which time he says he heard things never revealed to others. During this period, Mr. Elijah Muhammad and Master W.D. Fard went to Chicago and established Temple Number 2. They also established in Milwaukee the beginnings of a Temple Number 3. In 1934, Master W.D. Fard disappeared without a trace. Elijah Muhammad says that attempts were made upon his life because the other minister's jealousy had reached such a pitch. He says that these hypocrites forced him to flee to Chicago. Temple Number 2 became his headquarters until the hypocrites pursued him there, forcing him to flee again. In Washington, D.C., he began Temple Number 4. Also while there, in the Congressional Library, he studied books which he says Master W.D. Fard had told him contained different pieces of the truth that devil white man had recorded, but which were not in books generally available to the public. Saying that he was still pursued by the hypocrites, Mr. Muhammad fled from city to city, never staying long in any. Whenever able, now and then, he slipped home to see his wife and his 8 young children, who were fed by other poor Muslims who shared what little they had. Even Mr. Muhammad's original Chicago followers wouldn't know he was at home, for he says the hypocrites made serious efforts to kill him. In 1942, Mr. Muhammad was arrested. He says, Uncle Tom Negroes had tipped off the devil white man to his teachings, and he was charged by this devil white man with draft dodging, although he was too old for military service. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In the Milan, Michigan Federal Prison, Mr. Muhammad served 3.5 years. Then he was paroled. He'd returned to his work in 1946 to remove the blinders from the eyes of the black man and in the wilderness of North America. I can hear myself now, at the lectern in our little Muslim temple, passionately addressing my black brothers and sisters, this little, gentle, sweet man. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who is at this very hour teaching our brothers and sisters over there in Chicago, Allah's messenger, which makes him the most powerful black man in America for you and me. He has sacrificed 7 years on the run from filthy hypocrites. He spent another 3.5 years in a prison cage. He was put there by the devil white man. That devil white man does not want the Honorable Elijah Muhammad stirring awake the sleeping giant of you and me and all of our ignorant, brainwashed kind here in the white man's heaven and the black man's hell here in the wilderness of North America. I have sat at our messenger's feet, hearing the truth from his own mouth. I have pledged on my knees to Allah to tell the white man about his crimes and the black man the true teachings of our Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I don't care if it costs my life. This was my attitude. These were my uncompromising words uttered anywhere without hesitation or fear. I was his most faithful servant. And I know today that I did believe in him more firmly than he believed in himself. In the years to come, I was going to have to face a psychological and spiritual crisis. Chapter 13, Minister Malcolm X. I quit the Ford Motor Company's Lincoln Mercury Division. It had become clear to me that Mr. Muhammad needed ministers to spread his teachings, to establish more temples among the 22 million black brothers who are brainwashed and sleeping in the cities of North America. My decision came relatively quickly. I've always been an activist. My personal chemistry perhaps made me reach more quickly than most ministers in the Nation of Islam that stage of dedication. But every minister in the nation, in his own time, in his own way, in the privacy of his own soul, came to the conviction that it was written that all of his before life had been only conditioning and preparation to become a disciple of Mr. Muhammad's. Everything that happens, Islam teaches, is written. Mr. Muhammad invited me to visit his home in Chicago as often as possible while he trained me for months. Never in prison had I studied and absorbed so intensely as I did now under Mr. Muhammad's guidance. I was immersed in the worship rituals, in what he taught us were the true natures of men and women, the organizational and administrative procedures, the real meanings and the interrelated meanings and uses of the Bible and the Quran. I went to bed every night ever more awed. If not Allah, who else could have put such wisdom into that little humble lamb of a man from the Georgia fourth grade and sawmills and cotton patches? The lamb of a man analogy I drew for myself from the prophecy in the book of Revelations of a symbolic lamb with a two-edged sword in its mouth. Mr. Muhammad's two-edged sword was his teachings, which cut back and forth to free the black man's mind from the white man. My adoration of Mr. Muhammad grew in the sense of the Latin root word, adorare. It means much more than our adoration or adore. It means that my worship of him was so awesome that he was the first man whom I had ever feared. Not fear such as of a man with a gun, but the fear such as one has of the power of the sun. Mr. Muhammad, when he felt me able, permitted me to go to Boston. Brother Lloyd X lived there. He invited people whom he'd gotten interested in Islam to hear me in his living room. I quote what I said when I was just starting out, and then later on in other places, as I can best remember the general pattern that I used in successive phases in those days. I know that then I always like to start off with my favorite analogy of Mr. Muhammad. God has given Mr. Muhammad some sharp truth, I told them. It is like a two-edged sword. It cuts into you. It causes you great pain. But if you can take the truth, it will cure you and save you from what otherwise would be certain death. then I wouldn't waste any time to start opening their eyes about the devil white man. I know you don't realize the enormity, the horrors of the so-called Christian white man's crime. Not even in the Bible is there such a crime. God in his wrath struck down with fire the perpetrators of lesser crimes. 100 million of us black people, your grandparents, mine, murdered by this white man. To get 15 million of us here to make us his slaves on the way he murdered 100 million. I wish it was possible for me to show you the sea bottom in those days. The black bodies, the blood, the bones broken by boots and clubs. The pregnant black women who were thrown overboard if they got too sick. Thrown overboard to the sharks that had learned that following these slave ships was the way to grow fat. Why, the white man's raping of the black race's woman began right on those slave ships. The blue-eyed devil could not even wait until he got them here. Why, brothers and sisters, civilized mankind has never known such an orgy of greed and lust and murder. The dramatization of slavery never failed intensely to arouse Negroes hearing its horrors spelled out for the first time. It's unbelievable how many black men and women have let the white man fool them into holding an almost romantic idea of what slave days were like. And once I had them fired up with slavery, I would shift the scene to themselves. I want you, when you leave this room, to start to see all this whenever you see this devil white man. Oh yes, he's a devil. I just want you to start watching him in his places where he doesn't want you around. Watch him. Reveling in his preciousness and his exclusiveness and his vanity while he continues to subjugate you and me. Every time you see a white man, think about the devil you're seeing. Think of how it was in your slave foreparents' bloody, sweaty backs that he built this empire that's today the richest of all nations, where his evil and his greed caused him to be hated around the world. Every meeting, the people have been there before returned, bringing friends. None of them ever had heard the raps taken off the white man. I can't remember any black man ever in those living room audiences in Brother Lloyd X's home at 5 Wellington Street who didn't stand up immediately when I asked after each lecture. We'll all stand who believe what you have heard. And each Sunday night, some of them stood, while I could see others not quite ready when I asked, "How many of you want to follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?" Enough had stood up after about 3 months that we were able to open a little temple. I remember with what pleasure we rented some folding chairs. I was beside myself with joy when I could report to Mr. Muhammad a new temple address. It was when we got this little mosque that my sister Ella first began to come to hear me. She sat staring as though she couldn't believe it was me. Ella never moved, even when I'd only asked all who believed what they'd heard to stand up. She contributed when our collection was held. It didn't bother or challenge me at all about Ella. I never even thought about converting her. As tough-minded and cautious about joining anything as I personally knew her to be. I wouldn't have expected anyone short of Allah himself to have been able to convert Ella. I would close the meeting as Mr. Muhammad had taught me. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds, the Beneficent, Merciful Master of the Day of Judgment in which we now live. Thee alone do we serve, and thee alone do we beseech for thine aid. Guide us on the right path, the path of those upon whom thou hast bestowed favors, not of those upon whom thy wrath is brought down, nor the path of those who go astray after they've heard thy teaching. I bear witness that there is no God but thee, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is thy servant and apostle. I believed he had been divinely sent to our people by Allah himself. I would raise my hand for them to be dismissed. Do nothing unto anyone that you would not like to have done unto yourself. Seek peace and never be the aggressor. But if anyone attacks you, we do not teach you to turn the other cheek. May Allah bless you to be successful and victorious in all that you do. Except for that one day when I'd stayed with Ella on the way to Detroit after prison, I'd not been in the old Roxbury streets for 7 years. I went to have a reunion with Shorty. Shorty, when I found him, acted uncertain. The wire had told him I was in town and on some religious kick. He didn't know if I was serious or if I was another of the hustling preacher pimps to be found in every black ghetto, the ones with some little storefront churches of mostly hard-working older women who kept their pretty boy, young preacher dressed in sharp clothes and driving a fancy car. I quickly let Shorty know how serious I was with Islam. But then, talking the old street talk, I quickly put him at his ease, and we had a great reunion. We laughed until we cried at Shorty's dramatizations of his reactions when he heard that judge keep saying, "Count one, 10 years. Count two, 10 years. We talked about how having those white girls with us had gotten us 10 years, where we'd seen in prison plenty of worse offenders with far less time to serve. Shorty still had a little band, and he was doing fairly well. He was rightfully very proud that in prison he had studied music. I told him enough about Islam to see from his reactions that he didn't really want to hear it. In prison, he had misheard about our religion. He got me off the subject by making a joke. He said that he hadn't had enough pork chops and white women. I don't know if he has yet or not. I know that he's married to a white woman now, and he's fat as a hog from eating hog. I also saw John Hughes, the gambling house owner, and some others I'd known who were still around Roxbury. The wire about me had made them all uncomfortable, but my "what you know, Daddy" approach at least enabled us to have some conversations. I never mentioned Islam to most of them. I knew from what I'd been when I was with them how brainwashed they were. As Temple 11's minister, I served only briefly because as soon as I got it organized, by March 1954, I left it in charge of Minister Ulysses X, and the messenger moved me on to Philadelphia. The city of brotherly love black people reacted even faster to the truth about the white man than the Bostonians had, and Philadelphia's Temple 12 was established by the end of May. It had taken a little under 3 months. The next month, because of those Boston and Philadelphia successes, Mr. Muhammad appointed me to be the minister of Temple 7 in vital New York City. I can't start to describe for you my welter of emotions. For Mr. Muhammad's teachings really to resurrect American black people, Islam obviously had to grow very big. And nowhere in America was such a single temple potential available as in New York's 5 boroughs. They contained over 1 million black people. It was 9 years since West Indian Archie and I had been stalking the streets, momentarily expecting to try and shoot each other down like dogs.
"Red, my man, Red, this can't be you."
With my natural kinky red hair now close-cropped in place of the old long-haired, lye-cooked conch they'd always known on my head, I know I looked much different.
"Give me some skin, man. A drink here, bartender. What? You quit? Oh, man, come off it."
It was so good seeing so many whom I'd known so well. You can understand how that was. But it was West Indian Archie and Sammy the Pimp for whom I was primarily looking. And the first nasty shock came quickly about Sammy. He'd quit pimping. He'd gotten pretty high up in the numbers business and was doing well. Sammy even had married some fast young girl. But then, shortly after his wedding, one morning he was found lying dead across his bed. They said with $25,000 in his pockets. People don't want to believe the sums that even the minor underworld handles. Why, listen. In March 1964, a Chicago nickel-and-dime bets Wheel of Fortune man, Lawrence Wakefield, died, and over $760,000 in cash was in his apartment in sacks and bags, all taken from poor Negroes. And we wonder why we stay so poor. Sick about Sammy, I queried from bar to bar among old-timers for West Indian Archie. The wire hadn't reported him dead or living somewhere else, but none seemed to know where he was. I heard the usual hustler fates of so many others. Bullets, knives, prison, dope, diseases, insanity, alcoholism. I imagine it was about in that order. And so many of the survivors whom I knew as tough hyenas and wolves of the streets in the old days now were so pitiful. They'd known all the angles. But beneath that surface, they were poor, ignorant, untrained black men. Life had eased up on them and hyped them. I ran across close to 25 of these old-timers I'd known pretty well, when the space of 9 years had been reduced to the ghetto's minor scavenger hustles to scratch up room rent and food money. Some now worked downtown, messengers, janitors, things like that. I was thankful to Allah that I'd become a Muslim and escaped their fate. There was Cadillac Drake. He was a big, jolly, cigar-smoking, fat, black, gaudy-dressing pimp, a regular afternoon character when I was waiting on tables in Small's Paradise. Well, I recognized him shuffling toward me on the street. He'd gotten hooked on heroin. I'd heard that. He was the dirtiest, sloppiest bum you ever laid eyes on. I hurried past because we would both have been embarrassed if he recognized me. The kid who used to toss a dollar tip. The wire worked to locate West Indian Archie for me. The Why of the Streets, when it wants to, is something like Western Union with the FBI for messengers. In one of my early services at Temple 7, an old scavenger hustler to whom I gave a few dollars came up when services were dismissed. He told me that West Indian Archie was sick, living up in a rented room in the Bronx. I took a taxi to the address. West Indian Archie opened the door. He stood there in rumpled pajamas and barefooted, squinting at me. Have you ever seen someone who seemed a ghost of the person you remembered? It took him a few seconds to fix me in his memory. He exclaimed hoarsely, "Red, I'm so glad to see you." I all but hugged the old man. He was sick in that weak way. I helped him back. He sat down on the edge of his bed. I sat in his one chair, and I told him how his forcing me out of Harlem had saved my life by turning me in the direction of Islam. He said, "I always liked you, Red." And he said that he'd never really wanted to kill me. I told him it had made me shudder many times to think how close we'd come to killing each other. I told him I had sincerely thought I'd hit that combinated six-way number for the $300 he'd paid me. Archie said that he'd later wondered if he'd made some mistake, since I was so ready to die about it. And then we agreed that it wasn't worth even talking about. It didn't mean anything anymore. He kept saying over and over, in between other things, that he was so glad to see me. I went into a little of Mr. Muhammad's teaching with Archie. I told him how I'd found out that all of us who'd been in the streets were victims of the white man's society. I told Archie what I thought in prison about him, that his brain, which could tape record hundreds of number combinations a day, should have been put at the service of mathematics or science. "Red, that sure is something to think about," I can remember him saying. But neither of us would say that it was not too late. I had the feeling that he knew, as I could see, that the end was closing in on Archie. I became too moved about what he had been and what he had now become to be able to stay much longer. I didn't have much money, and he didn't want to accept what little I was able to press on him. But I made him take it. I keep having to remind myself that then, in June 1954, Temple 7 in New York City was a little storefront. Why, it's almost unbelievable that one bus couldn't have been filled with the Muslims in New York City. Even among our own black people in the Harlem ghetto, you could have said Muslim to 1,000, and maybe only one would not have asked you, "What's that?" As for white people, except for that relative handful privy to certain police or prison files, not 500 white people in all of America knew we existed. I began firing Mr. Muhammad's teaching of the New York members and the few friends they managed to bring in. And with each meeting, my discomfort grew that in Harlem, choked with poor, ignorant black men suffering all of the evils that Islam could cure, every time I lectured my heart out and then asked those who wanted to follow Mr. Muhammad to stand, only two or three would. And I have to admit, sometimes not that many. I think I was all the angrier with my own ineffectiveness because I knew the streets. I had to get myself together and think out the problem. And the big trouble, obviously, was that we were only one among the many voices of black discontent on every busy Harlem corner. The different nationalist groups, the Buy Black forces, and others like that. Dozens of their stepladder orators were trying to increase their followings. I had nothing against anyone trying to promote independence and unity among black men, but they still were making it tough for Mr. Muhammad's voice to be heard. In my first effort to get over this hurdle, I had some little leaflets printed. There wasn't a much-traveled Harlem street corner that five or six good Muslim brothers and I missed. We would step up right in front of a walking black man or woman so that they had to accept our leaflet. And if they hesitated one second, they had to hear us saying some catch things such as, "Hear how the white man kidnapped and robbed and raped our black race." Next, we went to work fishing on those Harlem corners, on the fringes of the nationalist meetings. The method today has many refinements. But then it consisted of working the always shifting edges of the audiences that others had managed to draw. At a nationalist meeting, everyone who was listening was interested in the revolution of the black race. We began to get visible results almost immediately after we began thrusting handbills in people's hands. "Come to hear us too, brother. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us how to cure the black man's spiritual, mental, moral, economic, and political sicknesses." I saw the new faces of our Temple 7 meetings. And then we discovered the best fishing audience of all. By far the best conditioned audience for Mr. Muhammad's teachings. The Christian churches. Our Sunday services were held at 2 p.m. All over Harlem during the hour or so before that, Christian church services were dismissing. We bypassed the larger churches with their higher ratio of so-called middle-class Negroes who were so full of pretense and status that they wouldn't be caught in our little storefront. We went fishing fast and furiously when those little evangelical storefront churches each let out their 30 to 50 people on the sidewalk. Come to hear us, brother, sister. You haven't heard anything until you've heard the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. These congregations were usually southern migrant people, usually older, who would go anywhere to hear what they called good preaching. These were the church congregations who were always putting out little signs announcing that inside they were selling fried chicken and chitlin dinners to raise some money. And three or four nights a week, they were in their storefront rehearsing for the next Sunday, I guess, shaking and rattling and rolling the gospels with their guitars and tambourines. I don't know if you know it, but there's a whole circuit of commercial gospel entertainers who have come out of these little churches in the city ghettos or from down south. People such as Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the Clara Ward singers, are examples. And there must be 500 lesser lights on the same general order. Mahalia Jackson, the greatest of them all. She was a preacher's daughter in Louisiana. She came up there to Chicago, where she worked cooking and scrubbing for white people, and then in a factory, while she sang in the Negro churches the gospel style that, when it caught on, made her the first Negro that Negroes ever made famous. She was selling hundreds of thousands of records among Negroes before white people ever knew who Mahalia Jackson was. Anyway, I know that somewhere I once read that Mahalia said that every time she can, she will slip unannounced into some little ghetto storefront church and sing with her people. She calls that my filling station. The black Christians we fished to our temple were conditioned, I found, by the very shock I could give them about what had been happening to them while they worshipped a blonde, blue-eyed god. I knew the temple that I could build if I could really get to those Christians. I tailored the teachings for them. I would start to speak and sometimes be so emotionally charged, I had to explain myself. You see my tears, brothers and sisters. Tears haven't been in my eyes since I was a young boy. But I cannot help this. When I feel the responsibility I have to help you comprehend for the first time what this white man's religion that we call Christianity has done to us. Brothers and sisters here for the first time, please don't let that shock you. I know you didn't expect this, because almost none of us black people have thought that maybe we were making a mistake, not wondering if there wasn't a special religion somewhere for us, a special religion for the black man. Well, there is such a religion. It's called Islam. Let me spell it for you. I-S-L-A-M. Islam. But I'm going to tell you about Islam a little later. First, we need to understand some things about this Christianity before we can understand why the answer for us is Islam. Brothers and sisters, the white man has brainwashed us black people to fasten our gaze upon a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. We're worshiping a Jesus that doesn't even look like us. Oh, yes. Now, just bear with me. Listen to the teachings of the messenger of Allah, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Now, just think of this. The blonde-haired, blue-eyed white man has taught you and me to worship a white Jesus and to shout and sing and pray to this God that's his God, the white man's God. The white man has taught us to shout and sing and pray until we die, to wait until death for some dreamy heaven in the hereafter when we're dead. While this white man has his milk and honey in the streets paved with golden dollars right here on this earth. You don't want to believe what I'm telling you, brothers and sisters? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You go out of here, you just take a good look around where you live. Look at not only how you live, but look at how anybody that you know lives. That way you'll be sure that you're not just a bad luck accident. And when you get through looking at where you live, then you take you a walk down across Central Park and start to look at what this white God has brought to the white man. I mean, take yourself a look down there at how the white man is living. And don't stop there. In fact, you won't be able to stop for long. His doormen are going to tell you, move on. But catch a subway and keep on downtown. Anywhere you may want to get off, look at the white man's apartments, businesses. Go right on down to the tip of Manhattan Island that this devilish white man stole from the trusting Indians for $24. Look at his city hall down there. Look at his Wall Street. Look at yourself. Look at his God. I'd learned early one important thing, and that was to always teach in terms that the people could understand. Also, where the nationalists whom we had fished were almost all men, among the storefront Christians, a heavy preponderance were women, and I had the sense to offer something special for them. Beautiful black woman. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that the black man is going around saying he wants respect. Well, the black man never will get anybody's respect until he first learns to respect his own women. The black man needs today to stand up and throw off the weaknesses imposed upon him by the slave master white man. The black man needs to start today to shelter and protect and respect his black women. 100% would stand up without hesitation when I said, how many believe what they have heard? But still never more than an agonizing few would stand up when I invited, will those stand who want to follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? I knew that our strict moral code and discipline was what repelled them most. I fired at this point at the reason for our code. The white man wants black men to stay immoral, unclean, and ignorant. As long as we stay in these conditions, we will keep on begging him and he will control us. We never can win freedom and justice and equality until we are doing something for ourselves. The code, of course, had to be explained to any who were tentatively interested in becoming Muslims. And the word got around in their little storefronts quickly, which is why they would come to hear me, yet wouldn't join Mr. Muhammad. Any fornication was absolutely forbidden in the Nation of Islam. Any eating of the filthy pork or other injurious or unhealthful foods. Any use of tobacco, alcohol, or narcotics. No Muslim who followed Elijah Muhammad could dance, gamble, date, attend movies or sports, or take long vacations from work. Muslims slept no more than health required. Any domestic quarreling, any discourtesy, especially to women, was not allowed. No lying or stealing, and no insubordination to civil authority except on the grounds of religious obligation. Our moral laws were policed by our fruit of Islam, able, dedicated, and trained Muslim men. Infractions resulted in suspension by Mr. Muhammad, or isolation for various periods, or even expulsion for the worst offenses from the only group that really cares about you. Temple 7 grew somewhat with each meeting. It just grew too slowly to suit me. During the weekdays, I traveled by bus and train. I taught each Wednesday at Philadelphia's Temple 12. I went to Springfield, Massachusetts, to try to start a new temple, a temple which Mr. Muhammad numbered 13 was established there with the help of Brother Osborne, who had first heard of Islam from me in prison. A lady visiting a Springfield meeting asked if I'd come to Hartford, where she lived. She specified the next Thursday and said she would assemble some friends, and I was right there. Thursday is traditionally domestic servants' day off. This sister had in her housing project apartment about 15 of the maids, cooks, chauffeurs, and housemen who worked for the Hartford area white people. You've heard that saying, no man is a hero to his valet. Well, those Negroes who waited on wealthy whites hand and foot opened their eyes quicker than most Negroes. And when they went fishing enough among more servants and other black people in and around Hartford, Mr. Muhammad before long was able to assign to a Hartford temple the number 14. And every Thursday I scheduled my teaching there. Mr. Muhammad, when I went to see him in Chicago, had to chastise me on some point during nearly every visit. I just couldn't keep from showing in some manner that, with his ministers equipped with the power of his message, I felt the nation should go much faster. His patience and his wisdom in chastising me would always humble me from head to foot. He said one time that no true leader burdened his followers with a greater load than they could carry, and no true leader sets too fast a pace for his followers to keep up. Most people seeing a man in an old touring car going real slow think the man doesn't want to go fast, Mr. Muhammad said. But the man knows that to drive any faster would destroy the old car. When he gets a fast car, then he will drive at a fast speed. And I remember him telling me another time when I complained about an inefficient minister at one of his mosques. I would rather have a mule I can depend upon than a racehorse that I can't depend upon. I knew that Mr. Muhammad wanted that fast car to drive. And I don't think you could pick the same number of faithful brothers and sisters from the Nation of Islam today and find fishing teams to beat the efforts of those who helped to bring growth to the Boston, Philadelphia, Springfield, Hartford, and New York temples. I'm, of course, just mentioning those that I knew most about because I was directly involved. This was through 1955. And 1955 was the year I made my first trip of any distance. It was to help open the temple that today is number 15 in Atlanta, Georgia. Any Muslim who ever moved for personal reasons from one city to another was, of course, exhorted to plant seeds for Mr. Muhammad. Brother James X, one of our top Temple 12 brothers, had interested enough black people in Atlanta so that when Mr. Muhammad was advised, he told me to go to Atlanta and hold a first meeting. I think I've had a hand in most of Mr. Muhammad's temples, but I'll never forget that opening in Atlanta. A funeral parlor was the only place large enough that Brother James X could afford to rent. Everything that the Nation of Islam did in those days, from Mr. Muhammad on down, was strictly on a shoestring. When we all arrived, though, a Christian Negro's funeral was just dismissing, so we had to wait a while, and we watched the mourners out. "You saw them all crying over their physical dead," I told our group when we got inside. "But the Nation of Islam is rejoicing over you, our mentally dead. That may shock you, but oh yes, you just don't realize how our whole black race in America is mentally dead. We are here today with Mr. Elijah Muhammad's teachings, which resurrect the black man from the dead." And speaking of funerals, I should mention that we never failed to get some new Muslims when non-Muslims, family and friends of a Muslim deceased, attended our short, moving ceremony that illustrated Mr. Muhammad's teaching, "Christians have their funerals for the living. Ours are for our departed." As the minister of several temples conducting the Muslim ceremony had occasionally fallen to my lot. As Mr. Muhammad had taught me, I would start by reading over the casket of the departed brother or sister a prayer to Allah. Next, I read a simple obituary record of his or her life. Then I usually read from Job, two passages in the 7th and 14th chapters, where Job speaks of no life after death. Then another passage where David, when his son died, spoke also of no life after death. To the audience before me, I explained why no tears were to be shed, and why we had no flowers or singing or organ playing. We shed tears for our brother, and gave him our music and our tears while he was alive. If he wasn't wept for and given our music and flowers then, well, now there is no need, because he is no longer aware. We now will give his family any money we might have spent. Appointed Muslim sisters quickly passed small trays from which everyone took a thin, round patty of peppermint candy. At my signal, the candy was put into mouths. We will file by now for a last look at our brother. We won't cry, just as we don't cry over candy. Just as this sweet candy will dissolve, so will our brother's sweetness that we have enjoyed when he lived, now dissolve into a sweetness in our memories. I've had probably a couple of hundred Muslims tell me that it was attending one of our funerals for a departed brother or sister that first turned them toward Allah. But I was to learn later that Mr. Muhammad's teaching about death and the Muslim funeral service was in drastic contradiction to what Islam taught in the East. We had grown, by 1956, well, sizable. Every temple had fished with enough success that there were far more Muslims, especially in the major cities of Detroit, Chicago, and New York, than anyone would have guessed from the outside. In fact, as you know, in the really big cities, you can have a very big organization, and if it makes no public show or noise, no one will necessarily be aware that it is around. But more than just increase in numbers, Mr. Muhammad's version of Islam now had been getting in some other types of black people. We began now getting those with some education, both academic and vocations and trades, and even some with positions in the white world. And all of this was starting to bring us closer to the desired fast car for Mr. Muhammad to drive. We had, for instance, some civil servants, some nurses, clerical workers, salesmen from the department stores. And one of the best things was that some brothers of this type were developing into smart, fine, aggressive young ministers for Mr. Muhammad. I went without a lot of sleep trying to merit his increasing evidences of trust and confidence in my efforts to help build our Nation of Islam. It was in 1956 that Mr. Muhammad was able to authorize Temple 7 to buy and assign for my use a new Chevrolet. The car was the Nation's, not mine. I had nothing that was mine but my clothes, wristwatch, and suitcase. As in the case of all of the Nation's ministers, my living expenses were paid, and I had some pocket money. Well, once you couldn't have named anything I wouldn't have done for money. Now money was the last thing to cross my mind. Anyway, in letting me know about the car, Mr. Muhammad told me he knew how I loved to roam, planting seeds for new Muslims or more temples, so he didn't want me to be tied down. In 5 months, I put about 30,000 miles of fishing on that car before I had an accident. Late one night, a brother and I were coming through Wethersfield, Connecticut, when I stopped for a red light and a car smashed into me from behind. I was just shook up, not hurt. That excited devil had a woman with him, hiding her face, so I knew she wasn't his wife. We were exchanging our identification. He lived in Meriden, Connecticut, when the police arrived, and their actions told me he was somebody important. I later found out he was one of Connecticut's most prominent politicians. I won't call his name. Anyway, Temple Sevens settled on a lawyer's advice, and that money went down in an Oldsmobile, the make of car I've been driving ever since. I'd always been very careful to stay completely clear of any personal closeness with any of the Muslim sisters. My total commitment to Islam demanded having no other interests, especially, I felt, no women. In almost every temple, at least one single sister had let out some broad hint that she thought I needed a wife. So I always made it clear that marriage had no interest for me whatsoever. I was too busy. Every month when I went to Chicago, I would find that some sister had written complaining to Mr. Muhammad that I talked so hard against women when I taught our special classes about the different natures of the two sexes. Now, Islam has very strict laws and teachings about women, the core of them being that the true nature of a man is to be strong, and a woman's true nature is to be weak. And while a man must at all times respect his woman, at the same time he needs to understand that he must control her if he expects to get her respect. But in those days, I had my own personal reasons. I wouldn't have considered it possible for me to love any woman. I'd had too much experience that women were only tricky, deceitful, untrustworthy flesh. I'd seen too many men ruined, or at least tied down, or in some other way messed up by women. Women talk too much. To tell a woman not to talk too much was like telling Jesse James not to carry a gun, or telling a hen not to cackle. Can you imagine Jesse James without a gun or a hen that didn't cackle? And for anyone in any kind of a leadership position, such as I was, the worst thing in the world that he could have was the wrong woman. Even Samson, the world's strongest man, was destroyed by the woman who slept in his arms. She was the one whose words hurt him. I mean, I'd had so much experience. I'd talked to too many prostitutes and mistresses. They knew more about a whole lot of husbands than the wives of those husbands did. The wives always filled their husbands' ears so full of wife complaints that it wasn't the wives. It was the prostitutes and mistresses who heard the husband's innermost problems and secrets. They thought of him and comforted him, and that included listening to him, and so he would tell them everything. Anyway, it had been 10 years since I thought anything about any mistress, I guess, and as a minister now, I was thinking even less about getting any wife. And Mr. Muhammad himself encouraged me to stay single. Temple Seven Sisters used to tell brothers, "You're just staying single because Brother Minister Malcolm never looks at anybody." No, I didn't make it any secret to any of those sisters how I felt. And yes, I did tell the brothers to be very, very careful. This sister, well, in 1956, she joined Temple Seven. I just noticed her, not with the slightest interest, you understand. For about the next year, I just noticed her. You know, she never would have dreamed I was even thinking about her. In fact, probably you couldn't have convinced I even knew her name. It was Sister Betty X. She was tall, brown-skinned, darker than I was, and she had brown eyes. I knew she was a native of Detroit and that she'd been a student at Tuskegee Institute down in Alabama, an education major. She was in New York at one of the big hospitals' school of nursing. She lectured to the Muslim girls in women's classes on hygiene and medical facts. I ought to explain that each weeknight, a different Muslim class or event is scheduled. Monday night, every temple's Fruit of Islam trains. People think this is just military drill, judo, karate, things like that, which is part of the FOI training, but only one part. The FOI spends a lot more time in lectures and discussions on men learning to be men. They deal with the responsibilities of a husband and father, what to expect of women, the rights of women which are not to be abrogated by the husband, the importance of the father-male image in the strong household, current events, why honesty and chastity are vital in a person, a home, a community, a nation, and a civilization, why one should bathe at least once each 24 hours, business principles, and things of that nature. Then Tuesday night at every Muslim temple is Unity Night, where the brothers and sisters enjoy each other's conversational company and refreshments, such as cookies and sweet and sour fruit punches. Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. is what is called student enrollment, where Islam's basic issues are discussed. It is about the equivalent of catechism class in the Catholic religion. Thursday nights, there are the MGT, Muslim Girls Training, and the GCC, General Civilization class, where the women and girls of Islam are taught how to keep homes, how to rear children, how to care for husbands, how to cook, sew, how to act at home and abroad, and other things that are important to being a good Muslim sister and mother and wife. Fridays are devoted to civilization night, when classes are held for brothers and sisters in the area of the domestic relations, emphasizing how both husbands and wives must understand and respect each other's true natures. Then Saturday night is for all Muslims a free night, when usually they visited each other's homes. And of course on Sundays, every Muslim temple holds its services. End of side 6.